Well, just to give a little bit of context as to what happened, there was a lot of rain around, and the whole first day was washed out. And when they got to actually play, there was it was very much conducive to the Anderson Broad type combination. And Anderson took 9 wickets for the match, 5 in the first innings and 4 in the second. And India skittled for 107 and 130. So going into the Test series, the issue was always going to be whether India could face the swinging ball.
Yes. Turns out
The
they
answer
can't.
is they can't.
Turns out they can't.
Negative.
Well, Colo was watching it all up close. He joins us again. G'day, Colo.
G'day, Harp. How are you?
Going very well, thank you. Now, we were very much looking forward to this second test after what happened in the first test. But with a couple of days left, what are they going to do, these blokes? 3 days was over and out.
Yeah, it was actually all over in 170 overs, which is the quickest test match completed at Lord's in the way of balls since 1888.
So, that's a long time.
The Lord's faithful didn't exactly get their value for money. India were abysmal in both innings, but in saying that, they got the worst of the conditions. The best comparison I can give is that if you put, say, Ashwin and Jadeja on a dust bowl in India, they're going to take a ton of wickets. The same goes for Anderson, Broad and Wokes bowling on, I wouldn't call it a green top, but a pitch that was quite favourable to swing and seam. And they absolutely tucked in. Sensational, a lot of them. They all bowled brilliantly through the test match. Couldn't have bowled any better on the surface. And India were thoroughly ill-equipped. And they were knocked over for 107 and 130 and a massive loss, which makes it 2-0 going into Nottingham, which traditionally is the strip that does the most in England. So it could be... it is a very big uphill battle for India to stay in the series.
And it was disappointing in a lot of ways, Adam, because at a point there in England's first innings, they were 5 for 131 with only a narrow lead, and it looked like it was game on because India were bowling quite well. And then an unlikely hero for England completely shut India out of the match.
It totally was game on. They took 4 wickets before lunch. It feels like a million years ago, but yesterday, on day 3 of the Test match, on sort of the marquee day of the marquee Test, you know, Lord's Saturday morning, sun beating down, which was the only time we had sun in the whole match. And India were doing quite nicely. But as you say, Chris Wokes, he replaced Ben Stokes, and often he's, you know, considered a poor man's Ben Stokes, really, on the basis that Stokes is such a dynamic match winner. But it's easily forgotten that Wokes, in his own right, was a Wisden Cricketer of the Year a couple of years ago. He was brilliant against Pakistan and Sri Lanka in 2016. Didn't quite have the returns he would have wanted in Australia last summer, but he's a bowler of serious capacity, and he debuted as a number six. I mean, it's back a while now, 5 years ago, but he was a number six batsman in his first test match against Australia, actually, at the Oval in 2013. So he's made 10 first-class hundreds. You don't do that if you're a jobber. So he was always someone who had the potential to do this kind of thing. But to bat as well as he did, alongside Johnny Bairstow, he's in wonderful nick. They took the game away. They put on 189. By the time they were finished, it was essentially game over.
Adam, we were talking after the first test. Would this be a series where Virat Kohli, we know he's a star of the game, but can really sort of announce himself as an all-time great? We know he's a super player. But in conditions like that, would he have been better off just to throw a little bit more caution in the wind? He looked in a lot of discomfort from ball one.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things going on there. First of all, he's got a bad back, so that's limiting his range of movement. We spoke to him tonight after play, and he will play at Nottingham, but it's hampered by that back injury. So I don't know to what extent that influenced his innings today. Look, he gritted it out to the extent that he could on Friday, but you can't overstate just how generous the conditions were when they got on late Friday afternoon. It rained all day for 2 days. It was completely juiced up. And Kohli played and missed pretty much everything. So, yeah, he probably could have been a fraction more conservative. But we saw last week at Edgbaston that he is the standout player in the world at the moment, especially with Steve Smith out of the game with his year-long suspension. So there's no questioning his capacity or his willpower or his determination to succeed. But it is very hard when you're carrying your whole batting line up on your shoulders. And that's certainly been the case in the first couple of weeks of the series.
What was his summary of the performance of his teammates in the second test?
Oh, look, he's trying to stay upbeat, but the subtext is fairly clear. He isn't getting the support he requires. His vice-captain, Ajinkya Rahane, has perhaps been the most culpable so far. He hasn't got the worst returns as players who've made fewer runs, but Rahane is a player of serious class. We saw what he did in Australia a couple of summers ago. He's been brilliant with the white ball, the red ball, 20-over cricket around the world, and for some reason he's playing the most extravagant shots out of the whole top six, which has been... It's not been befitting the series so far. It's been a series where you've needed to dig in. Both of these test matches have finished prematurely because the surface has had the ball moving laterally. So it's hard to kind of unstitch that. He's obviously a player out of form badly, and it must be very hard being that out of form in a series which is so high profile. It's the number one side in the world, travelling to England, the country where they got smashed in 2014. A lot riding on this. They're not going to lose the number one ranking, but, you know, it's touch and go. A lot of scrutiny on the way they played in England 4 years ago. So to be in such bad nick at this time, it doesn't augur well.
So you'd be saying no changes for England going to the next test, and also for India, will they look to make a change?
They might try and use Kiran Nair, who made a triple 100 against England the last time they played back in early 2017, maybe it was late 2016 when they played their last series in England. So I guess to that extent, he's got some form against the England bowling attack, although in very different conditions. As for England, well, I'll tell you this much, Ben Stokes won't be playing next week. Initially, I think there was a bit of a consensus forming that Stokes would be in court this week, or last week, as it were. It would be wrapped up in a week and he could be available again for the third test match. But the trial continues into day six tomorrow. It's still got a little bit of time to run yet, and who knows what will come at the end of that. So England, yes, they'll remain unchanged. Why change with the winning formula? As for India, yeah, Kiran Nair would be my bet. Although they might go back to Shikhar Dhawan, because Murali Vijay's in terrible nick as well. He made a pair at Lords, although he got a very, very good Anderson delivery today. Anderson took 9 for 43 match figures and wasn't man of the match, which says a fair bit about how well Wokes went. Anderson's now taken his most recent 405 test wickets, so out of 553, his last 405 have come at 23. Some numbers that were crunched tonight. So any cynics about Jimmy Anderson, and the longevity as well, the fact that he's still doing it at 36 years of age, 15 years after he debuted, I think that's an underrated quality in test match cricket, just how long these guys can go for as fast bowlers. He's done it superbly this week again, and he looks as fit as ever. So it might be the case that he's got a couple of years to go yet still as well.
Adam Collins with us from England after the second test between England and India. Demolished the home side by the opponents of India. Smacked them to bits inside 3 days. Did a big number on them. Hey, Colo, just on Anderson and Broad, will they ever retire, do you think? Because it just seems like, and you talk about 15 years, it just seems like they've got so much ability still in them and so much confidence to get out there and do it. The way they move that ball, I mean, obviously conditions suited this test match, but they're in phenomenal form.
Yeah, 977 wickets between them. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Broad today, he had a spell of 4 for 7 in 7 overs at one point. I'm surprised he didn't take a hat-trick. He was on a hat-trick. He picked up Kohli and Kartik in consecutive deliveries and was running it at Ashwin, and it felt like he was going to become the first man in Test cricket to take a third hat-trick. It wasn't to be. A massive in-swinger that went down the leg side for 4 byes, as it happens, with a kind of rare hat-trick ball. But all the same, there was some discussion at Edgbaston, and even yesterday, that Broad might be the weakest link in this bowling lineup, which I can't get to the bottom of the way that people think about Broad. Yes, he isn't as reliable as Anderson. You can't set and forget the way you can with Anderson, but this is a guy that has, on his day, the most lethal spells in him. We've seen the hat-trick of Ashes clinching spells in 2009 at the Oval, 2013 at Durham, and 2015 famously at Trent Bridge. He's a big game performer. He has a fantastic record, particularly in England, particularly bowling with Anderson. And he's 4 years Anderson's junior. There's no reason why Broad can't continue. He was bowling at 89 mile an hour in the old money today. So it's up on the screen in miles, not kilometres. So well above 140, 143, 145 at some stages, kilometres per hour. This isn't a man slowing down. This is a bloke, much like Anderson, who seems to be coming into his peak in his latter stage of his career.
Adam, you mentioned Stokes, of course, and a lot of chat around the ground. How much of it is hanging around the ground and, you know, a bit of a cloud, you know, that ongoing court case compared to what has been spoken about actually on the field?
I reckon had England performed poorly in this test match, we'd be talking about it a lot more, but it's funny what a win can do, especially a convincing one. The Stokes subplot leading into the test match was dominant. I'm not sure how much of it was covered back in Australia, but over here it was getting cricket back on the front page for the first time in a long time for all the wrong reasons. Probably the first time cricket's been on the front page since Stokes got into that strife last September. The evidence presented by the prosecution wasn't flattering towards Stokes in any way. nor was the way the judge seemed to be adjudicating the case. Stokes was cross-examined on Thursday and Friday last week. So the defence started in earnest, but look, it's hard to know where this lands. The fact that he's been charged with a fray and not assault has a lesser penalty associated to it if he's found guilty. So the probability of, for instance, him going to prison is lesser than it would be had he been charged with assault, which is what he was originally expecting he'd be charged with, or most people were expecting that after the footage went viral back last September. So he's lucky that he's not being charged with assault. But also, look, the broader atmospherics around it, the homophobia slant, which is pretty unflattering. Again, there's conjecture as to whether he was the man protecting the couple or whether he was the man vilifying the couple. It's very hard to tell based on the back and forth exchanges from court. So, and then not to mention the fact that, you know, you can't dispute the sheer volume of punches this guy threw in a situation where his teammate Alex Hales was telling him to stop. So, look, Stokes, taken as a whole, we'll know a lot more by the end of this week about what's going to happen with him, whether the ECB choose to hand out their own sanctions subsequently. You think they'd have to? He did miss the Winter Ashes series, so they could say, you know, time served, if you like, as his punishment. But it would be such a bad look if they didn't come down pretty hard, particularly if he gets found guilty of the affray charge and there is a serious sentence laid down by the court.
Now, on to really important things. The greatest season that was 1993. You're breaking all sorts of records. What's going on here? You've become an internet, what do they call it, phenomenon.
Phenomenon. You sound like Mel Walden. Phenomenon. Now, for those who don't know what it is, it's a podcast, the number one sports podcast in Australia that Adam, Dan Bredig, and Shannon Gill have got rolling. And it is, the numbers are extraordinary, Collo.
Yeah, I think we knew when we released the first step that this had a much bigger appetite, or there was a much bigger appetite for it than we even really considered. And yeah, the downloads have been huge. The word of mouth and the way people have shared it's been like humbling and greatly appreciated. The episode which drops this morning with Cameron Schwab is an absolute corker. Cameron, by way of background, he was chief executive of Richmond in 1993. He had been for 5 years. He was only 28 years old, which gives you a sense of just sort of how important an administrator he was at such a young age. But also it was the year that Alan Schwab died, his father, when he was up at Sydney trying to do that repair effort after what had happened in 1992 up there. And obviously he was also number two at the AFL under Ross Oakley. So it was a huge year for Cameron Schwab, but he gives a very revealing interview about not only that, but also his relationship with Alan Jeans. And he talks about the fact that Alan Jeans fundamentally didn't coach in Richmond in 1993 due to anxiety, which we never knew about. We never knew about this in the public domain in any case when Alan Jeans was alive. And Cameron, who had a strong relationship with Alan, talks candidly about that as well. So it is a lot about footy. It's a lot about nostalgia, no question about that. It's a lot about huge scores and an even season and the spearhead full forwards and the glamour of the game back then in a simpler time, no question. But there's also some serious elements to it as well and some hard edge. And hopefully we're managing that divide nicely and people are loving the old stories such as Robert Shaw, Ron Joseph and others who've been on the show so far. So, yeah, if you do have an interest in footy from 25 years ago, our contention is that it was the greatest season of all time. And judging by the response we've had, a lot of people agree with us.
I think you've got a man across the desk from me who's agreed with you for a long time that 93 was the best. He keeps talking about it, Adam.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Whitey and I have had this conversation frequently. And Fitzroy, Whitey's club, he's a Roy boy and they're a massive part of the story. They went 10-10 in 93. It was a 20-game season. And they should have made the finals. And as Whitey's had a chat to us on the show about in an episode we'll go to air later in the series, had they beat Essendon on that Friday night when they were flying, Fitzroy probably would have made the finals. And if they made the finals, maybe they're still with us today. I know that's kind of hard probably for Fitzroy people to hear, but it was that cup float at the time. Who knows what it would have done to the club, how it would have potentially retained players had they had a 1993 campaign that ended up in September rather than falling just short. It's something we've been interrogating, and a lot of people have had strong views on it. Not least Robert Shaw, who's just such a wonderful man, isn't he? He's a great person to talk to. The fact that he orchestrated a way of paying Marks and Oddie, their star recruit, they weren't allowed to draft. I should add, Marks and Oddie, and the club chairman said, "Do not you dare draft this man," and Robert did it anyway, and they had to pay himself. and he did it in gold coins from a raffle, selling Paul Roos and Alistair Lynch jumpers that they were raffling down with the painters and dockers. So in a brown paper bag full of gold coins, $1 coins and $2 coins on the back of his car, that's how they paid Mark Zanotti. This is just 25 years ago, now very much in our lifetimes. I mean, it wasn't long before you started playing the game at the top level half. So it gives you a flavour for just how much the game's changed, but in such a relatively short space of time.
Wow, that is fascinating. If you haven't checked it out, The Greatest Season That Was, 1993, is where you search your podcast, whatever the podcast apps you can search on. Just go and search it, because it's fantastic.
As a Fitzroy supporter, to hear Robert Shaw talk in detail about some of the things that happened that year, it was absolutely amazing and brought back so many amazing memories.
You're doing a great job in footy and in cricket at the moment, Colo. Long may it continue. Good on you, mate. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, half-most kind. Talk soon.